WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, very Charlie good. Becky, you ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, it is Monday. It is time for Monday Night Talk. We have a fantastic show for you. My name is Kevin Tachi, and... you a bit of the lineup as we have them coming in or calling in this evening. We start things off after we check in with George Brown. We do the final traffic check coming up in about 3 or 4 minutes. Jay Gonzalez. Jay is a Democrat running for governor here in the Commonwealth. Jay will be calling in, chat with us, tell us why he is the guy that you should consider come the primary in September and why he should be the guy who is running the Commonwealth come the beginning of 2019. So we'll talk with Jay about his run for governor. Then at 6:40, we have, it's called The Gloves Are Off, or The Gloves Are Off, and it's a reoccurring segment that we've had. It's almost like the, we used to have Red versus Blue. Remember that segment we used to have? Actually, if you go to the podcast site, you'll see some of the segments that we used to have with Craig Pina and Ed Miller. And, you know, the first couple of times we did it, it was a fantastic screaming match after a while. Kind of get old. So this is version 2.0, where we have two guys who want to be really, they want to be forthcoming in regards to the political climate. And they're willing to have the conversation, whether they agree or disagree. The idea is that it's a conversation that that we have, that you can enjoy and tune into. Second hour, we kick things off with Beth Lindstrom. Beth Lindstrom running for U.S. Senate, and she's one of three Republicans that are going to be on the ballot come September. Beth will be in studio joining us and talking about her campaign. And then at 7:30, we have a fantastic, this is a great segment. I only wish that this was a segment, and you're going to, this will be something that I'll probably say a couple more times, because I keep kicking myself. I wish I was able to have our final guest, Richard Fitz Jr., come in studio. Richard is actually working on a documentary called 21 Years, A Folded Flag. And it's about his dad who was a in the Green Beret, went missing while he was on a mission. Richard's going to come in and talk to us about putting together, compiling all this information, because when his father went missing, he was merely just a couple of years old. And so he's been learning about his father as he's been compiling all the information and putting together this this mini-doc. So we'll look forward to talking with Richard Fitz Jr. coming up at 7:30 p.m. So we look forward to that. And again, if you miss any of the segments here on Monday Night Talk, it's easy enough to go to the podcast site. Well, you don't have to necessarily go to the podcast site. Bennett's that easy. Ben, of course, is my producer, and he's dialing up the one and only George Brown, getting him on the air. You can go to the homepage of 959WATD. It's 959WATD.com. Scroll down, and we're on the left side, left-hand side. You'll see Monday Night Talk. This is the Ben. You click on it, and you'll see, well, pretty much all the segments that I've put together and put up over the past 8 years. So you can go back into the archives as far back as you want to hear some of the great segments that we had. Or you can go to iTunes. We're available in iTunes. And I believe I'm getting the high sign. We We're ready to cruise into the WATD Traffic Center for the final time this evening. Being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at BrennanSmokeShopMA.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now Pope's Island, New Bedford. And Mr. Brown is joining us. George, how is it out there?
Well, Kevin, we're still seeing a lot of volume leaving the city now. Southbound leaving the O'Neill Tunnel. It's heavy and slow down past South Bay. Brakes free for a bit. Then you'll hit the brakes again. Deposit Circle down to the Braintree Split. Northbound looks good most of the way into the city till you get to the tunnel. It's very heavy getting in. Route 3 southbound is slow coming off the expressway. Down past Union Street, then it breaks free pretty quickly down along the South Shore. No problems northbound on Route 3. Route 24 looks good at the top through Randolph and Avon. It just gets heavy passing over 495. If you're heading on and off the Cape, we're not seeing any delays at the Sagamore or the Bourne Bridge. A girl in Kenya dreams of becoming a doctor. An elder in Guatemala dreams of being part of a community. Reach out and change their world. It'll change your own at unbound.org. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm George Brown in WATD Traffic Center.
Big Poppy David Ortiz himself will be at Brennan's Smoke Shop in Rainham Tuesday, June 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. selling signed boxes of his Big Poppy cigars. Meet the man himself at this very limited opportunity Tuesday, June 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Raynham. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
All right, we return and we open the books on the program this evening. And joining us is a gentleman who, I believe during the Democratic Convention, the recent Democratic Convention, less than a couple of weeks ago, he garnered 70% of the party support. Of course, he'll be on the ballot come September, first week of September. Joining us right now is Mr. Jake Gonzalez, who is the former Secretary of Administration and Finance for former Governor Deval Patrick. Jay, welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, if you will, tell us a little bit about yourself, folks who don't already know who you are. A little bit about yourself, and tell us about the decision to want to be the next governor of the Commonwealth.
Sure. So I am currently a Democratic candidate for governor, have been for 17 months, getting all over the state, meeting lots of people. I've got a great family, wonderful wife, two daughters. As you mentioned, I served in Governor Patrick's administration as one of his cabinet secretaries overseeing the state budget. The last job I had before becoming unemployed and running for governor full-time was running a health insurance company that covered low-income people in the Medicaid program here and in New Hampshire. And I left that job to run for governor because I think we need a governor that's going to actually try to make a difference in regular people's lives. We've got a governor right now who is only there for the wealthy special interests who fill his campaign coffers and is dragging Massachusetts backwards. And I think we need to be aiming much higher. We've got a lot of big challenges that people all across the state are facing. And we need a governor that's fighting for them. It's fighting for all the little guys out there, all the regular people, whether it's for a transportation system that they can actually depend on to get to work on time, or a healthcare system that gives them access to the healthcare services they need, or a public education system that instead of laying teachers off all across the state is making sure we're providing a great public education to every child in this state. And we've got a governor right now that is not only not making progress on those issues and many others, he's literally not even trying. And I'm going to be a very different governor. I'm going to fight for all the regular people out there who need help and stand up for every single person in this state.
I will tell you, looking over your website, looking over the list of issues, each one of those issues starts with the phrase. Actually, during your answer to my initial question, you mentioned the phrase "aim high." Why is that such a key phrase in your campaign?
Because one of the things I love about us as a country and as a state is we have always believed we can overcome any challenge if we put our mind to it and work for it. And Massachusetts in particular, I mean, think about it. We started the Revolutionary War. We established the first public school, the first state to recognize one's right to marry whoever you love, the first to make universal health insurance coverage a reality. We've always been a leader. And right now, we've got a governor who basically just accepts the world the way it exists and tries to manage it better. And it's not good enough, and it's not consistent with who we are. We've got, as I mentioned, there are a lot of big challenges I hear about from people all along the campaign trail all the time. And it's not good enough to just accept the world the way it exists. We need a governor that's going to be aiming high, consistent with our values and who we are as a people, and really work to make progress on a whole slew of issues that our current governor isn't even trying to make progress on.
As we started off the program mentioning was that you were the one who garnered the most support from your party during the convention. How difficult has it been to be able to build a campaign war chest to be able to tackle the primary in September and hopefully beyond?
Well, we've got a lot of momentum right now. I'm feeling really good about the state of our campaign. As you mentioned, we earned 70% of the vote at the Democratic State Convention and the endorsement of the party. And so that was a big win. We've got a lot of momentum coming off it. You know, I've never run for public office before, and we've already raised about $750,000 in this campaign. We've got thousands of volunteers and supporters all across this state. We've got a very strong grassroots campaign that we continue to build on, and I'm very confident we're going to raise the resources we need to continue to grow that grassroots campaign and make sure people at the end of the day are informed about the choice in this election. And if they're informed about the choice, I'm 100% confident we're going to win. And it's a choice between a governor who, as I said, is only there for the wealthy special interests who fill his campaign coffers versus someone who's going to fight for the little guy and someone who's dragging Massachusetts backwards versus someone who's going to make Massachusetts a leader again. And I think people are going to choose that. One additional piece of evidence of our momentum, which I'll share with you, you and your listeners are the first I'm sharing it with, is I'm going to be in Taunton tomorrow to accept the endorsement of Mark Pacheco for our campaign, which I'm very proud to have. He's someone who fights hard for working people all across the state and in his district, and has been a real leader on progressive issues. So I'm very grateful to be getting his support, and I'll be there with him to announce that tomorrow.
Okay, we're speaking with Jay Gonzalez, who is a Democratic candidate for governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and he's our guest here on Monday Night Talk. And so we're going to get right into the meat and potatoes of the conversation here. The current administration has had its share of problems with the state's transportation system. Have you devised a plan to be able to provide infrastructure and be able to improve the MBTA?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a great example of an area. His whole case, Governor Baker's whole case for being governor, is he's a great manager, said he's going to fix the T in our transportation system across the state, and it's worse. And, you know, his whole approach is jacking up fares on riders, which just drives more people to the roads, cutting service, particularly in underserved communities, which just drives more people to the roads, privatizing these core public services, which we see how that's working out with the private contract for the operation of the commuter rail, where services have been terrible. And as a result, we now have one of the worst transportation systems in the country. We're 45th in the country in our condition of our infrastructure and 47th in terms of commute times. And it's dragging Massachusetts backwards. This is something that affects people's quality of life in a very real way every single day. I hear about it everywhere I go on the campaign trail. I'm going to be honest with people about the fact we need to invest more in our system. It is the fundamental problem. We've got to have a sense of urgency about this. I support the so-called millionaire's tax to generate meaningful new revenue at the state level that we desperately need to get the T and our roads and bridges and transit systems all across the state to a place where people can depend on it to get to work on time. The other thing I will do is I will fire Keolis, the private operator of the commuter rail system. I'll be the first governor to bring that the management of that system in-house under the direct control and management of the MBTA. You know, every time service levels are terrible and someone complains about it, Charlie Baker points the finger at Keolis, the private operator, and says, oh, yeah, they're doing a bad job. Well, he's the governor. He is the governor, and it's his responsibility to ensure that service is being delivered for people in a way they can depend on. And when I'm governor, they will be able to depend on it.
As kind of a little of a follow-up question in regards to the transit system, under the current governor, he's still working on the South Coast Rail project. Is that something that I know that's something that was re-stimulated under Governor Patrick? It was something that was talked about in the late 90s. There was a conversation about putting something through the Taunton area. Give me your take on the South Coast Rail and finally getting it to completion and being a useful rail system.
Yeah, well, you know, I am. So I worked with Governor Patrick on the South Coast Rail project when I served in his administration. And as you mentioned, he was the one who got that project started. And it was an ambitious project under Governor Patrick where we were going to do the Stoughton route, which was the most direct route, would have been a huge economic boon for the South Coast. And I've been very disappointed with the approach Governor Baker's taken, which is basically to change the route. It's going to add a bunch of time for the commute for people on the South Coast to get in and out of Boston. And it basically is undercutting the entire purpose of the project. So, you know, I would like to not be asking people on the South Coast to have to compromise to get this project done. This is a regional equity issue. It's a regional economic development issue. And, you know, when I get elected, I'm going to be stuck with wherever the project is under Governor Baker, which he has not been moving forward as quickly as he should. But to the extent it's feasible to reconsider and move to the Stoughton route, which would be a much better project from my perspective and an investment that's well worth taxpayer money, then that's what I would prefer to do. I don't want to have to ask people on the South Coast to have to compromise in terms of the service level that they are going to get and that they deserve.
Probably another looming issue here in the Commonwealth is the opioid epidemic. In your opinion, what needs to be done to further tackle this problem? There have been things that have been instituted under this administration. Give your take on where things stand when it comes to this problem.
Yeah, it is a huge crisis in this state. It's ruining people's lives, ravaging communities all across the state. There's no place where I don't hear about it. Pretty much everywhere I go. One of my campaign volunteers just a couple of months ago lost her son to an opioid overdose. Mm. So this is a huge crisis. And, you know, my take on where we are is we're in a much worse place than when Charlie Baker took office. There are many more people dying of opioid overdoses than 3.5 years ago when he took office. There are many more people showing up with overdoses in emergency rooms. The scope of the problem has only grown. And I think we need to be taking it on much more aggressively than Charlie Baker is. I have committed that I'm going to be investing much more in treatment resources so that we've got the treatment resources to meet the demand for these services, which right now they aren't nearly sufficient. I'm going to stop treating people who are addicted like criminals. Charlie Baker is sending people who are addicted to opioids who haven't committed a crime, who are civilly committed for treatment, to a Department of Corrections facility in Plymouth where they aren't getting the treatment they need. It's crazy, and I would stop that. I also think we need to try some new things and be bold. I've said that we should make health insurance companies cover medical marijuana as an alternative pain management therapy so that people aren't taking these pills that are addictive. And we also should be establishing safe injection sites because we aren't going to be able to get people into the treatment they need if they don't stay alive. So we've got to be aggressive about this and treat it with the urgency that the crisis demands, and I will do that.
How about in regards to any legislation or maybe any suit in regards to either the pharmaceutical companies that were basically pushing opioids or the drug dealers who were on the street who were pushing heroin? What's your opinion in regards to legislation or any kind of action to be able to get some kind of recourse? And maybe if you go after, maybe if elected officials go after the pharmaceutical companies to help pay for this epidemic that they helped create, maybe this would be able to help in treating these people who are addicted.
Yeah, we absolutely need to do that, and I'm glad you mentioned it. It's similar to what happened with tobacco, where, you know, cigarettes were killing people, a huge public health crisis. The tobacco companies knew about it and weren't telling anyone, and as a result, states sued the tobacco companies and got a huge settlement, where the state of Massachusetts and many other states have been getting significant funds for years to invest in public health and treatment of people who are sick because of it. We need to do the same thing with the opioid drug companies. As you mentioned, it's a very analogous situation where it seems clear they knew these pills, these pain pills, were addictive and weren't doing anything about it, and were aggressively marketing them and telling doctors it's okay to prescribe them and they aren't addictive. There are states that have been have filed suit against these companies, and Massachusetts should absolutely be one of them and be aggressive about going after them, because they are part of the reason why we've got this crisis, and they should be paying for a lot of the costs that we're incurring to help get people into the treatment they need and deal with the consequences of it.
Yeah, we're speaking with Jay Gonzalez, who is running for governor. He is a Democrat. Jay, I'm going to ask you a selfish question as a member of the media.
Okay. Now,
as a member of the media, it's never ever to do my job, to go out and report on stuff. It's never easy to gain access to information, especially from state and local government agencies. If elected, would you be willing to share records from your office, information from your office?
Well, thank you for raising that question. For those who don't know, Massachusetts is one of only two states in the country where the governor's office is exempt from the public records law. And Charlie Baker, and he's not the only governor, governors before him, have refused to disclose public records to the media and to the public under this exemption. And I have said that when I'm governor, that will stop. I will not only file legislation to eliminate the exemption and make the governor's office subject to the public records law, but I will voluntarily comply with the public records law. Government policy needs to be influenced by regular people, not just the wealthy special interests, all the friends of Charlie Baker, who he constantly makes decisions for, but regular people. And in order for regular people to be well informed about what government is acting upon and how decisions are being made and what the issues are that are being dealt with through good media coverage and just through their own diligence, they and the media need to have access to these records, and they should. They're not the governor's records, they're the people's records. And when I'm governor, they will be open to you and to everybody else who wants to see them.
Now, I'm going to ask you the regular Joe question. What does Jay Gonzalez like to do in his free time when he's not out and fighting for the little person? What do you like to do in your what do you like to do in your free time?
It's hard to remember having free time. I love to spend time with my family. I've got a wonderful wife and two daughters. So spending time with them first and foremost is what I love to do. Love being outside. I'm a runner. Love running, and I love eating good food. So I'm often on the search for and hunt for great places to eat all around Massachusetts.
Wow, sounds like a radio show you could do right here on 95.9 WATD. Keep it in mind.
All right, we'll do.
Well, last question I'll ask you. Is there any topic or issue that you didn't get a chance to at least comment on that you want to take a moment or two to do so?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners. I just want to encourage your listeners to think hard about this race. You know, when I talk to they support Charlie Baker and ask them why they support him, the answer is never that they think he's doing a good job fixing our transportation system or making progress on some other issue that affects people's lives. It's usually something like, he seems nice, and I'm really glad he isn't a crazy Republican like exists in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the measure of whether our governor's doing a good job or not shouldn't be that he's nice and isn't crazy, right? Like, we should expect more. We've got a lot of big challenges we're facing, and Charlie Baker is not doing anything to make any progress on any of the big issues that people face, whether it's affordable housing or a broken transportation system or access to affordable child care and preschool. You name it, there are tons of big issues holding people back. And you can have a governor that's nice and not crazy and doing a bad job on all of that stuff, or a governor who's nice and not crazy and will do a good job on all of that stuff. And that's what I'm offering, someone who's going to fight for regular people and stand up for every single person in this state. And I think the people of Massachusetts deserve that, and I hope to earn your vote.
Website, social media, how can folks find you?
Our website has a lot of great information on it. It's jayforma.com, jay4ma.com. And you can get the information for how to access our Facebook page and Twitter account on the website.
I got to give a thumbs up to your campaign staff for being able to connect you, have you on the air, especially CM Vasquez, your press aide, who did a phenomenal job.
He's
thumbs
great.
Up.
Yeah.
Thumbs up to him.
Well, thank you for calling him out. He's great. We're lucky to have him and lots of other great people on our team, and I hope to earn the support of all your listeners.
Well, we hope to have you back on here in the near future and get an idea as to where the campaign is at particular times leading up to September and hopefully November.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time, Jay.
All right. Take care.
There he is. Jay Gonzalez, a Democratic candidate for governor here in the Commonwealth. He's one of a couple of individuals who are going to be on the ballot. I believe Bob Massey is the other individual. He might even have some independents. I think you have on the Republican side opposing the governor is Scott Lively. Don't have the ballot in front of me, but those are just some of the names that just kind of pop up in my head here. We are going to just catch our breath for a couple of moments. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
The Yugo Motor Car, introduced 1977. Proudly displayed in shopping malls across America, at $4,000, it was the cheapest new car you could buy. And the Yugo exceeded all expectations of cheapness. It would not start, it would not go, the windows would not open. Enter Tony. Fix it again, Tony. He got his Yugo to start, he got his Yugo to go. In fact, the Yugo replaced all his hobbies, except one, kayaking. Pop the kayak in the back hatch, hit a bump, rear window whacks the bow, the window pops out unbroken. The Yugo, tough as glass.
I'm Peter from Tiny and Sons Glass in Pembroke. We've never had to replace a windshield in a Yugo, but for all you non-Yugo drivers out there, we do replace your windshields. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
All right. Well, this is, again, as I teased it early on, I've teased this. This is, I think, the third installment. I'm getting a finger point here, so you need me to turn it up just a little bit so you can hear it in the headphone. Is that good? All right. Of course, that I'm guiding Mr. Brian Cook. And, of course, we have Stephen Gill. They make up the gloves of the gloves are off. If you will, please cue the music.
He's playing it. Rick Ray's
1958 Rumble. Lucked up. Normally, I don't have people go, "Hey, you want to play this?" They listen and I go, "Oh yeah, it's." I think of Pulp Fiction personally, but
instrumental banned in Boston in 1958 for being too suggestive.
And so this is a no-nonsense, honest-to-goodness conversation that we have. These are two individuals who have run for office previously. For all I know, they might be on the ballot again real soon. We'll find out by the end of this conversation, at least by the top of the hour, if, in fact, either one of them have decided to throw their hat into the ring, proverbially. So we'll
Brian,
start with
I didn't
that.
Know you were doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, it's really exciting because...
You know, they need a good person up in the 5th Plymouth District. You know.
5th Plymouth? Do I have to think about it? I'll have to look at my map.
Gee, I wonder why they need that.
But I'll tell you, it's the only business in the world that people don't expect to get anything for what they pay. I'm always astounded. You know, you go to a restaurant, you want to come out well-fed. You go to Walmart, you want to come out with your cart filled. But people will spend money on politicians and on elections, and then 4 years later they'll say, geez, I didn't really get anything for that. And that's really what Steve and I have been talking about, is sort of not holding people's feet to the fire, but getting them to realize that we can make a difference, we can make changes. I'm in the middle of the best and the brightest right now, and I'm just fascinated by what went on at that point in time when people really believed we can make a difference. And now we say, eh, it is what it is.
The last time we talked, we were talking about some of the changes that we're seeing here, the political landscape that we're viewing here on the South Shore. You got two state representatives who have gone on to other jobs, who have gone to higher callings, so to speak. It seems as though our conversation may end up starting off with there's a void in the 5th Plymouth District. There was a Democrat who was going to be on the ballot. I don't know if there was going to be a number. I believe that the individual, Deidre Hall, who is also a Rockland Select person, who is a little bit of a, I don't know if you listen to 95.9 WATD, but it's a little bit of a scandal brewing in the town of Rockland. How much do you guys know about this?
Yeah, I've heard all about this right here off WATD, and from what I've read in what news sources I can get my hands on that will bother to cover it.
You just say WATD, that covers it. Because everybody else is basically just trying to reshuffle what we've been out there reporting,
well, there
our reporters are out there doing.
And if I'm not mistaken, apparently Ms. Hall and another member of the
town administrator,
yes. From what I've gathered, from what I've looked at, were out having a good time at the local establishments and found themselves back at town hall for a liaison. And someone found this out, and now she's dropped out of the race because she was running as the only Democrat for the 5th Plymouth. And now the Democratic Party again is caught with its pants down. They missed the filing deadline.
Literally.
At the Secretary of State's office, they missed the filing deadline to get their substitute in. And so now there's only one person in the primary as we speak today. It is the incumbent, DeCoste.
Dave DeCoste.
Republican. Yep. DeCoste. And they're scrambling to try to find someone to get 150 write-in votes so they can have a Democrat on the ticket. But talk about the Democratic Party. We've talked about this in the past couple of installments. The party throws all its efforts and energy behind their darling. Their darling turns out to be less than a darling. And now they're in trouble.
Yeah, it is interesting. I just had this conversation with some people in the party, and I find it astounding that when someone runs for office and doesn't win, it's as if they become part of the animals that are extinct in America. People forget they existed. No one wants to recycle unless you're Mitt Romney. But for the most part, the view is you ran, you didn't win, you're done, let's move on. And I just find it astounding they don't maintain a database of people who care, who will either stay involved or support somebody else or maybe even be a resource to figure out who's next. But to get caught with no candidate is amazing.
Don't you feel, though, that the voting public gets tired of the perennial candidate?
Oh, no, I think...
The face that pops up every other year and they want to run. Or if they weren't successful at seeking one office,
now,
they run for another.
I would agree with you if you didn't use the word Ronald Reagan or other people, Nixon, other
well,
people
I didn't use
who
the word
ran.
Ronald Reagan. You did. But, but if you need to say Ronald Reagan, then it'll make an argument.
Someone who runs and loses 4 or 5 times, and then everyone says, nope, doesn't have a chance, and the next thing you know, they're president.
I think you want somebody like that. You know why? That person's a fighter. That person is willing to say, you know what? Try again. I mean, that's what America is made of.
Other than Elizabeth Warren, no one wins on the first time out. Everybody, Barack Obama took an amazing defeat his first time he ran for the Senate in Illinois. It is unbelievable how often it happens, but you're right. In this McDonald's, I call it the McDonaldization of the world, we all want to be served in 6 seconds or less, is that candidates come up with the internet and everything else that's available. We know who, what, and where they are almost instantly, and we make an immediate decision on their ability to lead. Then we elect them, we put them in office, and we don't go back and check to see whether they did the job. We just keep reelecting them year after year after year. I mean, Steve and I made the great mistake of getting in line behind a line when everybody was running for office. Now it looks like there's going to be 80 or 90% of the state is going to be running without any competition.
Yeah, well, the big disappointment for me with this 5th Plymouth District's scenario is no one stepped up to be an independent and take out papers for that seat.
That we know of.
I know, because I called the Secretary of State's office and I said, is there anybody else who took out papers? And they said no. I said, there's no one enrolled, folks? And they told me no. So DeCoste is the one and only.
Well, let's go to the next step. Did anybody step up and say, geez, this was wrong? Or did we just move on to the next candidate? I mean, because that's really the question that I keep focusing on, is what do we expect from the people that we're asking to lead us? And when they fail us, how do we respond?
Hey, listen, and speaking of when they fail us...
Are you going to reveal the fact of the law checking that you wanted to report on? Is this what you're, segueing to?
Exactly. You like how I just stole that away?
Very
like
well done.
So as you know, that when I have things to say. I like to think that I'm right. And when I go back and I find out that I was not exactly right, I like to come back and correct myself.
Wow. Do that anymore?
I don't think people do that anymore. I think they just lie and then say that was that and it's fake news and I'm right and your facts are wrong. So I went back. I stated last time we were on about, I was talking about double dipping and two pensions for state employees. Now, that had been the law years ago, which is what I was recollecting. Now, I was only part right in that. I went and reviewed Chapter 32, Section 105 of the General Laws regarding pensions.
Didn't you do that too, Kev? I did that. I went right home and picked up.
I did. I couldn't sleep without doing so.
And I remember calling you, and you called me.
I cited something about Charlie Lincoln Plymouth County and stuff like that.
Go ahead.
Did we jump the shark here?
That's fine. Apparently, there is only one branch that can do the double dipping, and that apparently, sadly, my branch, the judiciary. Mm-hmm. If you're a member of the judiciary and you get your pension, you can then switch over to either the executive branch or the legislative branch and get a second pension, double dip. Not being one to rest on my laurels reading the law, I actually telephoned PERAC today, which is the Public Employees Retirement Something Commission, and was confirmed by their law department that in fact, is correct. So
if you are on the bench and then you take your pension, you can then run for public office?
And get another one.
Now, what did John Quincy Adams do? He was president. He came back and ran for a state rep position, I believe, in Massachusetts, and served in the Massachusetts State House.
Right, but that's federal, and the state laws wouldn't apply, and these state laws weren't in existence.
So he'd have his federal pension, and he'd have his state pension on the other side.
I don't even think they had pensions back then.
I want to segue to something that you actually turned... an ongoing legal battle into an adjective. You want to address the Weinsteining of America.
The Weinsteining.
Yes, the Weinsteining is the reason why politicians don't seem to want to do anything about things that matter.
Well, it is astounding to me that we spent the weekend talking about whether or not Donald Trump did the classic Canadian-American hockey game of pulling Trudeau's shirt over his head and hitting him four times. We looked into how he was going to treat the North Koreans, and I found myself sitting in traffic today, heading towards Weymouth, thinking, this is what matters. Even the situation with the Me Too situation, that's a real issue. And it's time for people to step up and say, we can't tolerate this anymore. This can't continue to go on.
Right.
You know, one of my favorite quotes is, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good people do nothing. And that's why I keep looking at our politicians saying, we're asking you to do something. We're asking you to lead us. So take some of these issues that matter to us. Guns in school, women not getting paid the same amount as men get paid, how our seniors are treated, why our veterans are homeless. And turn to your political leaders and say, why aren't you doing anything about this? What is it that you do every year for your $70,000 or $80,000? And in this situation we just talked about in Rockland, now I understand why so many elected officials are becoming town managers. What a benefit package.
Again, you are listening to 95.9 WATD. It's Monday Night Talk, and the segment, The Gloves Are Off, with Brian Cook, Stephen Gill, as the individuals here kind of discussing some of the issues, some of the items that we may see in the news, or just kind of, it's kind of that asking why. That's what we're trying to do today. And we're going to try to do this on a somewhat regular basis.
Can I ask
a
really important question?
Sure. I might have a really important answer.
Well, I want to ask the why of Steve Gill as to why, Steve.
Ooh.
And Steve has to tell us, like Jeopardy, what the question is.
Sorry, guys.
Why? Why am I a candidate for State Senator in the Plymouth and Norfolk District?
The great reveal.
Again?
That was like a softball.
Thank you.
Why will my name be on the ballot at the general election on November 6th of this year?
Yes, please tell us.
All right. Well, the issue that really got me hot under the collar, and you just alluded to it, Brian, and this is deadly serious. We've been having fun here, but this is a deadly serious issue. And we are now in the 23rd week of the calendar year, and we have had, according to CNN, 23 school shootings across our country. One a week.
Crazy.
Now, you would think that any person in a position of authority, like our current state senator, Patrick O'Connor, would, when he had a chance, vote against... vote for a ban on bump stocks and trigger cranks. However, and you can check this on the official records with the Mass Legislature, it's the official Senate roll call number 224 from October 26, 2017 on House Bill 3979, which had adopted the Senate Bill number 2194, which included the bump stock ban and the trigger crank ban. Patrick O'Connor voted no. He didn't want those things. He also, as the minority whip, it was his job to ensure that all the other Republicans voted in line on that issue and refused to ban bump stocks and trigger cranks. This is your state senator, parents, who walks around and says repeatedly when he shows up at high school graduations and so on and is glad-handing people and says, the South Shore, what a great place to raise a family. And he won't do the simplest thing of saying, yes, we're going to ban trigger cranks and bump stocks to keep the kids safe.
Well, Stephen, as a veteran, let me ask you to confirm what I heard, which was sort of what woke me up and shocked me, which is more children have been killed in schools this year than soldiers in battle around the globe.
Sounds about right, yeah. With one a week, absolutely.
So do you have a website up? Tell us again. You're officially making an announcement that you are going to be running for state senate.
Stephen Gill, independent candidate for state senate in the Plymouth and Norfolk District. You will see my name on the general election ballot on November 6th because independents don't have to go through a primary process. As I did last time when I was stuck as a Republican, and I still managed to get 25% of the Republican vote, I want to thank all the Republicans out there in the district that did cast their vote for me. Patrick O'Connor spent $200,000. He got three-quarters of the vote. I spent $2,000. I got a quarter of the vote.
Well, Steve, I do need to warn you that the South Shore Democratic Caucus told me that being an independent thinker is not a good thing.
I'd have to disagree.
Well, we're just about out of time. Anything you guys want to say in closing of this, the third installment of The Gloves Are Off?
I actually do, Kevin. What I want to say is thank you to you and to WATD to have the courage to let Gil and I actually come on live and speak to the people who listen to you every week.
Oh, you haven't got my bill yet. Nothing comes for free. No, I'm kidding. No, it's, again, the idea is just to be able to stimulate conversation and be able to have individuals in to stimulate that conversation, to have things to talk about. And so you guys, and Brian, you were the one who came to me a couple of months ago saying, I got this idea. And we discussed it, and it's been something that I hear back from folks who they like the conversation. They That's like great. The frank conversation, and hopefully we can keep it up.
We promise we won't let them down, and I know in Steve's effort to join those folks up at the State House, he won't let them down either.
My website will be up and running soon. It's not up as of yet, but folks, you know, I'm sure I'll have that information out at some point.
Hey, can I just throw one last thing in at the end, Kevin?
You got 20 seconds.
Bob Hedlund, what he's done in Weymouth in terms of facilities, the Legion Field, the Libby Field, the baseball diamond that's just open, that's the kind of thing that makes people wake up and say, hey, someone did something. Thank you, Bob.
Excellent. All right, well, it's a hell of a way to close out the first hour of Monday Night Talk. Brian, Stephen, thank you. Thank you, Stephen, for making that announcement about your candidacy for State Senate. We'll talk more with you down the road.
Thanks, Kevin.
We're going to step aside. Second hour of Monday Night Talk on deck right here, 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
Mohammed, you are the most celebrated champion in pugilistic history.
Cosell, I float like a butterfly, I sting like a bee. I am the greatest.
Yet doubters claim that Liston is too big, too strong, too mean to defeat. No place to hide.
Cosell, you needs a whooping. I predict a total eclipse of the sun. And Cosell, take this for doubting me. He's down. He's out. I knew it, Cosell. You got a glass jaw.
Glass problems? I'm Peter of Tiny and Sons Glass. We come to your work, your home, or your prize ring to replace your auto glass. Insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Big Poppy David Ortiz himself will be at Brennan's Smoke Shop in Rainham Tuesday, June 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. selling signed boxes of his Big Poppy cigars. Meet the man himself at this very limited, very limited, very limited opportunity Tuesday, June 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Rainham. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to say the first hour was pretty good. Second hour is going to be even better. Again, just kind of teasing the hour. Later this hour, 7:30, Richard Fitz Jr. Talk a little bit about his documentary, 21 Years of Folded Flag. You're not going to want to miss that. And you're not going to want to miss my next guest. She is running for U.S. Senate. We have Beth Lindstrom as our guest in studio.
I am here.
She's here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Where are you coming from? You actually were at a local event?
We were in Plymouth and before that, Rockland.
My goodness, you're getting around.
Yeah. Busy day, but all good. All good. Yeah.
Folks who don't know who you are, obviously they know who you are because during the Republican convention, you did well enough to be able to be on the ballot in September.
I did. We were very excited about that. So,
tease us with who you are.
Sure. Well, I have a long history being around politics. I started the Republican State Party in 1987 when Ray Shammy was chairman of the party and had a lot of good luck there because we elected Bill Weld, Paul Slucci, and Joe Malone, and enough state senators to sustain Governor Weld's veto. So that was very good. And then I ran Scott Brown's first race, the one that was successful, we say. I was an advisor to Mitt Romney when he decided to run for governor, so helped him become governor. And most recently, I was president of a super PAC called Commonwealth Future, which helped elect Charlie Baker and Karen Pulido. So I've had that long political history. I've also held two senior positions in government. I was the first woman director of the lottery, and so very proud of that.
Congrats.
When I was down there, I had a 17-month-old and a 7-week-old, and I put myself through graduate school at Northeastern University.
God bless you.
So while working full-time. And then I later on was on Governor Romney's cabinet as Secretary of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation. Did a lot there. Been involved in 4 startup companies, and I'm a small business owner. So that's kind of the whole spectrum of experience.
My God, so many hats, one head.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Why? What made you want to go from being the mind, the brains behind successful candidates to wanting to be the candidate?
Well, as I said, I've been around for a long time witnessing success on a statewide candidates in Massachusetts, knowing it can be done. But truly, I was watching TV in the morning, and I'd watch Elizabeth Warren, and I would be blow-drying my hair, and I'd have an argument in my head with her. So I decided it was time to step forward. At this point in my life, I actually lost a close friend a couple years ago, and when that happens to you, you said, what is my purpose in life? And I said, we don't know what tomorrow brings, so I'm going to take this challenge. So it's a big challenge. Elizabeth Warren, a big challenge.
Talk to me about the issues, and I got a list of issues here. And these are issues that I've compiled not only from past races, but I've been doing this long enough, I kind of get an idea as to what they are. I know you're not somebody who's the normal politician.
Well, this is my first time as a candidate. I have not run before. So I think that I bring something different to this race, just a different perspective. Like I just said, all that background.
Yep.
And especially from a small business owner. That's very different from
what's
our
What's your business? Feel free to
Sure.
promote. Yep.
Well, I have a small business in Groton, Massachusetts, of course.
Okay.
It's called Body, Mind, Spirit, and it's a salon and day spa. Every woman should have their own salon and day spa. But, no, I looked at this opportunity, and it's great because I've got, you know, about 8 employees and incent the managers. Great. We're actually moving our business from one location to another, and it's very good. So, thank you.
Talk to us about the economy. Talk to me about jobs. What do you feel that can be further, what can be done further to stimulate our national economy? What would you like to do as far as setting policy?
Well, let me say that I agree with these tax reforms. I think we're seeing the benefits of that here in Massachusetts. Myself as a small business owner, that piece of the policy has made an impact on moving our business into a new location because of the 20% pass-through as a small business owner. Again, contrasting to Elizabeth Warren, who has not had any of this experience, knows what it's like to, I know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck. You know, I don't think she's had that experience. But with regard to the tax reform, good things happen. We need to make sure we continue to have pro-growth policies, and that's really important in Massachusetts. So I want to maybe make some of those things in the tax cut permanent, like the child tax credit, because I do think that's my basic philosophy. And running against Elizabeth Warren, I have a fundamental disagreement with her about the role of government. You know, she believes government creates jobs. I believe people do. And when people create jobs, you create taxpayers. But jobs don't get created unless there's a good economic environment. And we are seeing that in our history right now. Lowest unemployment rate. Wages are rising. It's because you're able to cut taxes, make it so that people and business owners have the ability to spend more money and invest in their companies and their people.
I think the thing I would ask you is anybody who understands how the economy works, they understand that it's cyclical. Mm-hmm. And it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. And it doesn't matter who the person is down in the White House most times. It's just a matter of how extended of a time it is when it's doing well or when it's struggling. Do you feel that any particular policy, even if it's something that the Trump administration sets, is going to be something that'll at least extend our good fortune when it comes to the economy?
I do think that, because you look at the Obama administration and our growth of GDP was always less than 2%. I mean, it was stagnant. So, and it was those, policies. Now we actually have something that is actionable, where people, you're seeing these things happen. That's why it was getting frustrating. 8 years of stagnation, and now we're seeing these things happen because of these tax cuts and this policy.
One of the things that a lot of Americans care about, and it's probably one of the most expensive things when it comes to your household, is health care. Mm-hmm. We know that under the current administration that there was an attempt to try to invoke some kind of a reform. Depending on the midterm vote, which is going to be very important come later this year, can the GOP put together a plan to be able to replace the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think that they already tried that, and so I think what we need to focus on here in Massachusetts, and we do have one of the best systems in the country. We have almost 97% of the people covered, and I was on Governor Romney's cabinet when we did Romney Care,
right?
And so we need to stabilize the system. We need to make some tweaks, but what the difference is making sure that we still get the $400 million in federal monies. I mean, we need to make sure, if you reverse that money goes away, and that's a big hit to our economy. I think the biggest thing is looking at Elizabeth Warren, where she wants to take this to, on her progressive agenda, to socialize medicine, single payer. And that would disrupt our Massachusetts industry in an incredible way. And, that to me doesn't make sense. We need to stabilize it, fix it, because we do have many people covered here in Massachusetts.
Would it be best, I've heard different arguments, to be able to replace what we have, where maybe it's something. Look at Massachusetts again, the birthplace of Romney Care, mm-hmm. which again became Obamacare.
But that was using free markets. That was a private market when it started. And then it became different. That's when it became Obamacare.
But so what I'm asking you is would it be best to let states dictate health care instead of the federal government?
Yes. I'm a states' rights person, so okay. I think it's better to... Everything is better decided at a local level. And so every state... I mean, why don't they model after Massachusetts? Mm. I mean, that might be... And that might be one of the things, too, if you start to sell insurance across state lines. I mean, if everybody started to get their industries in line where Massachusetts is, then maybe we could have more competition throughout the United States.
Again, we are speaking with U.S. Senate candidate Beth Lindstrom. She's here in studio talking about her campaign, hoping that you will vote come September. Mm-hmm. I think it's the first week of September. It's kind of an odd...
It's September 4th, right after
Labor Day.
It's
very weird, very unusual this year. Her website, Beth4Senate, that's F-O-R, .com. She'll repeat that at the end of the segment. So I'm just kind of getting it in there for the moment. I think one of the issues that is going to be interesting, whether it's the candidates who are seeking the Republican nod or the individual who comes out on the end and is facing Elizabeth Warren, immigration reform is going to be huge. Mm-hmm. Give me your thoughts on being able to get an attainable immigration reform under President Trump.
Well, I think there's a lot of good people that want to come to the table and fix it. We've politicized it for so long. Sure. We just need to fix it. But where I differ is Elizabeth Warren, who goes around the country advocating for sanctuary cities. We need to secure our borders. We need to follow the law. That's where I am. Follow the law. Let's fix it. The president put a deal on the table, which I thought was a pretty good deal. And, the Democrats want to politicize this. They want to keep that going for the midterms. I think we need to fix it. That's just at the end of the day. We need to secure our borders that define us as a nation, which, yes, that's a wall. But that might have different forms also. It might be an additional people on the ground. Could be technology. We need to fix it. Bad things happen at the border. We see that. The trafficking, drugs.
Trafficking, yep.
Human trafficking. We need to fix it.
So are you more concerned with the southern border, or are you concerned with our border with Canada, seeing we had a little bit of a dust-up at the G7 convention?
Well, I think that you have seen lately the people who are now trying to get into Canada, and you see Canada having the same policies of you have to follow the law. So don't think that you're going to come here and just try to get in illegally. We have to stop telling the world it's easier to come here illegally than legally. And I'm all for legal immigration. I think it makes our country rich and diverse. But we need to follow the law. Mm. That's just what we need to do.
Do you think it's a matter of finances when it comes to building a wall? I know when Donald Trump was running for president, he was going to... promise was that Mexico was going to pay for it. Now there's been a little bit of a dialing back, and it seems as though it might be something that the American people are going to be financing to begin with. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I think you saw in the last omnibus budget that there were some monies to work a few thousand miles or something like that. So I think it's a work in progress, I would say. But like I said, maybe there's some that are drones. Maybe there's different technology. Maybe it's fencing. I mean, I think it has to be a comprehensive approach to looking at it. I don't think it makes sense, probably the whole wall, the whole border. But let's figure out the why. Let's figure out what we need to do and where, and put that on the table.
Okay. Let's kind of stay with U.S. policy, if it's a foreign mm-hmm. policy, if it's okay. You look at our president and his administration, and the president has taken a very abrupt approach to a lot of things. Some people find it refreshing. Others are fearful that how we're trying to reassert ourselves as a country could cause more global issues, including, look at, we're all probably on the brink of a trade war. Does this concern you as an individual who could possibly be a member of the U.S. Senate mm-hmm. will have to deal with putting forth policies when it comes to the global market?
Well, I think that I'm a peace through strength person. I believe that, you know, when America is strong, America is prosperous. So what he is doing in North Korea is historic. This is historic regardless. Step out of the forest and look into the trees rather than trying to, you know, speculate on everything that's happening. Is the meeting going to happen? Is it not going to happen? I mean, what he's doing is bringing people to the table. And sometimes, yes, you have to be a little bit stronger and then maybe dial back a little bit. You can't dissect every move. But when it comes to what's going on, the G summit and so forth, I mean, he, you know, I think it's about free trade at the end of the day. I mean, you look at the whole NAFTA, you look at Mexico, Canada. I mean, maybe that's the place to get the results from China. So, you know, when you pick apart every little piece of the process, that you got to kind of look at it holistically. And I think at the end of the day, you know, where I am on trade is a free market, free trade, but fair trade. And maybe if there's some place to have these, I mean, this is not new to us. This has happened in our history.
Correct.
So it's, you just have to have it short, targeted for duration, accomplish the objective, and then, you know, take it away and move on.
Do you feel that our current president is in the vein of a Ronald Reagan, who's he talks tough and follows through with that? Again, you mentioned NAFTA, which personally I felt that was a wrong step for our country to go in. Okay, you could be friendly with the countries that are north and south of our border and beyond, but is that going to cost the American economy? Is it going to cost jobs?
And we'll see. Like markets, everything could be cyclical, and something, you know, I don't think we can project, but let's put the policy in place. If that's what he wants to do, he is the president, and see the ramifications and then adjust. I don't think everything is set in stone on these tariffs. So I think we're just going to have to do a wait and see.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about education. Knowing that Massachusetts is probably one of the top states in the nation when it comes to education, mm-hmm. Education reform. Whether it's K through 12, whether it's higher education, it seems as though the costs continue to rise. What can be done to be able to better fund education here in the state and across the country?
Well, as a U.S. senator, how much role, you know, what role would you have in education? And for me, it's you know, the people closest to the students make the better decisions. Mm. And so, for me, I'm about school choice. I think that the more choices parents have, the better for the students. And that's where it is at the end of the day, is what is right for the students. So I think that, you know, the more choices, if, you know, why should parents in an urban area have to submit their children to an underperforming school? So there should be choices out there. I have three boys, and they all have learning challenges. I probably would have diagnosed, you know, down the road. But, yeah, but finding the right place for them that makes them thrive, I've witnessed that personally in my family. So I think what is right for that student, meeting them at their own, where they are, is more important. And so how can we create these schools that serve them the best?
Okay, we're speaking with Beth Lindstrom. She is a candidate for U.S. Senate. She's a Republican and looking for your vote come September 4th. Talk to me about conversations you've had here within the district. I'm sure you've had chances to speak with residents, voters, elected officials on all levels. What are you hearing from them?
I think it's about business, small business, and regulations, and less government. That's what I hear. Because the more mandates, the more things you put on small business and businesses, the less they can grow. And it's about jobs. At the end of the day, it's about jobs. When you have a job, you have dignity. You get to put and provide for your family. And that's the bottom line. That's the goal. Good things happen from there because it does work in the community. And we met with someone today who is a business, and they're struggling because the business model has changed. Talked to someone today about training for veterans, and is it appropriate, or are there other things we can do for veterans in trying to get them jobs? So I'm just hearing a lot about jobs. It's about jobs and regulations.
Being here in Marshfield and going out to folks in Scituate, you were down in Plymouth. You talk about Massachusetts having its share of coastal communities. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest conversations that are being had is about the National Flood Insurance Program.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that keeps getting kicked down the road. Nothing yet has been put into place for affordable flood insurance. And we're also coming off a couple of years where we had issues with the mm-hmm. FEMA flood maps.
Yeah.
What are you willing to do as a state, as a senator, a U.S. senator, to make sure that your district, the Commonwealth, is going to be protected when it comes to flood insurance and the FEMA flood maps?
Well, I think that we need to look at a solution at the end of the day that makes sense. I know they were talking about a seawall, $11 billion. I think there was a study from UMass that said it's just, that doesn't make sense. Maybe there
is that
are,
the one that was in Boston Harbor? That might have been the one in Boston Harbor.
Yeah.
It was something that they had that they were looking at a model from, I don't know if it was another country, where it'd be able to prevent water coming into Boston Harbor, so mm-hmm. to speak, especially during the winter months when Mother Nature is at her height.
Well, and if we do anything on flood insurance, I would make sure you grandfather the people that already that have it, so it's not a market shock. But when I was consumer affairs secretary, we actually introduced competition in the auto insurance market. And here was what was interesting about this: is we had such a regional market that the big players wouldn't play here, and they wouldn't cover. So we didn't have the benefit of a book of business that you could offset by the earthquakes in California. But by being able to introduce competition, which we worked for 2 years across the aisle to bring into Massachusetts, that enabled us to eventually bring in these larger writers, which again opened up the markets. So when people could potentially, now the flood insurance is it's a national insurance, but maybe someday there could be private insurance for flood insurance and maybe have more competition in the market. I mean, to me, I'm a free market person
You're right. With the free market, at least you know that there's going to be competition,
right,
which will create lower rates and better plans for the residents and those who are going to seek out those plans.
Right, because you couldn't buy any flood insurance back then.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't even get it because no one would sell it to you. So, I mean, and if you
big
had
risk.
A flood, it's only one time, good for one time. Anyway, I think it needs to be looked at, but, certainly building seawalls and using taxpayer money that way, we need to do smaller projects that will make a difference.
But as somebody who might be able to get earmarked money to be able to either look at better ways to construct seawalls
mm-hmm.
Or be able to get money to be able to build a new seawall.
Well, you Marshfield. Hit something on the head,
yeah.
And that's about actually getting something for the people of Massachusetts.
Right.
And where Elizabeth Warren and her inability to create relationships or get anything from this administration, even though regardless of who is the president, you need to be able to build relationships, something I have done through the years, as I just mentioned in automobile insurance competition. She's not able to make those relationships, and that's something that will leave the Massachusetts people behind, especially if she's running for president. Let me get that in. We can talk about that maybe a little after the break, but this is something that's really important, is getting at the end of the day benefits and results for the people of Massachusetts.
How important is that to have in your toolbox as somebody who is able to talk across the aisle? It seems as though the folks down in Washington, D.C., that's one thing that there's a struggle, is just folks being able to work with mm-hmm. individuals from the other party or folks who might be a little bit further left or right in their party and be able to get everybody on board to focus on the issue at hand. How do you feel that that's an asset that you have?
Well, first of all, we've had a long history in Massachusetts of, you go out and do your election, but then you come together and you work with each other and you're able to come back. It's really too bad that in Massachusetts we don't have one Republican as a congressperson or a U.S. senator, and you lose that diversity of opinion. And so when you look at the U.S. Senate, there's 22 women in Congress. There's six women in the Senate that are Republican. And so just to have that diversity of opinion, we don't have that here in Massachusetts. And if I'm the woman who is the nominee in September, I'd be the very first Republican woman ever in Massachusetts history to run for U.S. Senate. So I think that's something that we should have.
Sounds like a plan. I want to kind of talk about something that's not only, I'd like to think that it's something that is important and something that's been tackled here in the Commonwealth, but it's something that's happening across the country, and that is the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your thoughts on what needs to be done on the federal level to tackle this problem.
Well, you need to figure out the why, and you need to figure out the solution. Mm-hmm. But I would love to partner with our Governor Charlie Baker and Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido on what they've already done in terms of trying to solve this problem. But it does take money and it does take time, because I think what I'm observing is that you do need to go into a rehab longer than 30, 60 days, probably 90. Well, that takes money and that takes the ability to build those centers. But where, and I believe I could work with them, and I could work in Washington as the representative. Elizabeth Warren didn't even vote for the 21st Century Cures Act, which every single other person in the Congress in Massachusetts did, that would have brought opioid money. I mean, the money's coming because everybody did vote for it, but she didn't. So, and the reason why she didn't, because Bernie Sanders didn't, because that's part of her presidential play. And so that doesn't help us here in Massachusetts.
You know, what's even more interesting is that back in 2016, the Commonwealth voted for recreational marijuana. Prior to that, mm-hmm. they looked to decriminalize marijuana and also allow medical marijuana. Problem is that this is something that is a no-no when it comes to the federal government.
Right.
Is there anything that you feel you could do or that you'd like to help lead to either decriminalize this on the federal level, or do you feel that it's a gateway drug? Folks feel as though marijuana, I get a couple of different conversations that some folks say, well, it's okay. And then there are others saying, hey, it's a gateway drug. And it's what leads to harder drugs.
Yep. And I'll tell you, I didn't personally vote for that. I have my own feelings about it. But the people have spoken in Massachusetts. And we do need to reconcile the federal-state issues. Mm. But with Elizabeth Warren, I think it's fair to say that, you know, is the first thing she wants to do, put a pot shop on every corner, you know, rather than to promote other businesses. And I do think it's a gateway drug. And so, to me, I think her priorities are backward, because she did not vote for tax reform. She said that it was going to kill people. It was horrible. Well, to me, I think we should ask the question, why is this your first priority?
We just got a couple of minutes left with you, Beth, and I want to thank you very much for coming in studio, sitting down and having a great conversation. Is there anything that I haven't asked you but you feel is a topic or an issue that you want to at least speak to for a moment or two?
Well, sure. I would say, yes, I am in a primary, but my position is that I'm the best chance to win against Elizabeth Warren in the general. So I wanted to make that point because, you know, we do have a primary September 4th. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to it, you look at where Elizabeth Warren won in 2012. It was a presidential year. Obama won by 23%. She only won by 7%. So she was a flawed candidate behind there. But she did win the women's vote for about 19%. So for me, don't vote for me just because I'm a woman. Vote for me because where I stand on the issues and because of my accomplishments. But that's a big deal. So I am the best person who can go up against her in the general.
One of two questions left I have to ask you.
Okay.
One's a personal question. What does Beth Lindstrom like to do when she's not on the campaign trail or working her tail off? What do you like to do in your spare time?
Well, in the wintertime, I do like to ski. I did not do that this year because I was a little busy.
Okay.
So I certainly, and I ride in the Pan Mass Challenge. So
192 miles.
Well, actually, so let me pull that back. I've done the 192 before.
Okay.
But last 2 years, I've only done Bourne to P-Town. This year, I'm going to do Wellesley to Bourne, Bourne to P-Town. So I'm trying to fit my training rides in as best I can when I can.
Watch for August 4th and 5th.
Yes.
Out there on the trails. Folks want to find out more about your campaign.
How can
they do that? And before I say anything else, let's give it up to Katie, who did a fantastic job of making sure you got here. And your team.
Yes.
Nikayla?
Yep, we have a Nikayla Chinnaswamy, Katie Trudeau. I'm not supposed to announce your last names, but we have a campaign office in Needham, and you can locate us at Beth4Senate, FOR.com, and check us out. We are welcoming to anybody who wants to be a part of our campaign.
Beth, I want to thank you very much again for coming in studio. We look forward to having more conversations
with
you. Not necessarily in studio, because we know that you're out and about, but
sure.
Love to have you check in. Katie, I'm looking at you, so And I'll also email Nikayla and check in with her. But best of luck.
Thank you.
Out there talking to the folks in the Commonwealth.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We're going to step aside, and when we come back, we're going to talk about 21 Years of Folded Flag, a documentary. We're going to talk to the man who has worked to put this together, Richard Fitz Jr., on deck here on Monday Night Talk, heard only on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And this is an intriguing segment. It's something that having a conversation prior to our coming on mic here with our next guest, this would have been a perfect segment for Memorial Day. My next guest is the son of a gentleman who went missing in Vietnam. Imagine if you are someone who you have a mom, you don't necessarily know your dad, but you know that your dad was somebody who served his country, but nobody knows what happened to him. Well, joining us today is Mr. Richard Fitz Jr., and he's here to talk a little bit about his dad, Green Beret Staff Sergeant Richard Fitz. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you, sir.
If you will, tell us a little bit about yourself as the person who is in the works putting together a documentary about the whereabouts of your dad.
Well, I guess I have a few different titles when it pertains to this particular story. Obviously, I am my father's only son, and I carry the title of Gold Star Son, which means your family member was killed in action.
Right.
And basically, I was, 2 years old when my father was killed, and through my life's experience, I kind of grew up and kind of went a different direction, because if you don't know things, you don't continue to harp on them. For many ways, emotionally especially, and you have a choice where you're faced with either do you move on with your life or do you not. And so I moved on with my life and grew up. First of all, we were in Abington. We were all local. Both my grandparents were from Abington, along with my mother and my father. Mid-70s, we moved to Pembroke, and my mother started a horse farm. I eventually came a long-haired rock and roll guitar player, musician in my spare time, and I am now telling a story, and I do own a business that I do restorations and furniture and whatnot. So I guess I'm a mild-mannered gentleman trying to tell a story.
What were the early days of the story of what became of your dad? I'm sure that as you're going to school and you're going to school with your peers, and yes, some of those individuals have mothers and fathers, but yet you, what were you told as far as what became of your dad?
Well, we didn't know much. I was aware that he was a Green Beret. But at an early age, when you're younger, you know, and you talk to your peers, you and your peers really don't understand the depth of what that is, as far as, you know, military or what, you know, what that involves, what they do. So it was how I knew life. There was no other, I had nothing else to compare it to. It was always something I, you know, wondered. It was always something that I never, there was no answers. But that's how I knew life. I knew my father wasn't around. He knew my father was missing. And all I could tell you is, yeah, my father was a Green Beret and he's missing. And, you know, little kids that you talk to don't get that. Neither did I.
And you look at the war that he was involved with. It's a war that wasn't necessarily a popular war. To this day, those veterans who serve are slowly getting the respect that they deserve, that they served their country during this conflict. So it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't like a World War One or a World War II. This was a conflict that we were immersed in as a country. So that also had to have some kind of bearing on you, no?
It did. Whether or not at the time I was aware of it when I was younger, I don't really know how to answer that question. What I do know is people, in especially my father's case, as we talk about that war, a lot of that war was based on draftees. In my father's case, he was an enlisted man, and so he volunteered, and he also volunteered for Special Forces training and volunteered for the unit that we really delve into in this documentary.
Yeah, talk to us about this mission that he was on. I believe that the copter that he was on was called the King Bee. What's your understanding of the mission that basically he was lost in?
Well, we didn't really find out a lot of those details. They were trickled in for many years, but early on we knew nothing. But as far as what I found out, if that particular mission, again, where this unit was so highly classified for so long, none of this was ever talked about until a lot of research. And the mission was codename Eldest Son. And that was basically, to kind of set things up, it was a sabotage type of deal. And they were, the CIA had specialists in Okinawa and a few other areas, but a lot of times when these teams would go out, they'd find caches or ammunition or whatever, and they'd steal it. And they would send it out to these specialists, and they would open up this ammunition, and they'd rig it to explode. And they'd put everything back together so you couldn't tell that it was tampered with. And these particular munitions were peppered along all different types of areas. Some of the smaller ammunition, like the 7.62, a common round, that was out of China that our enemies were using, some of those would be put in areas. Sometimes they'd only put one round in a magazine, so they, once it went off, the fire pin would blow right through the head, but they couldn't trace any more. So, you know, there was a lot of strategic, you know, goals for this particular situation. But this mission was to put in mortar rounds. They had found a cache. So I do believe they had like a half a dozen cases of mortar rounds that were all rigged. And a volunteer mission, like we say, we describe it on the documentary, hey, we need people to go and do this. And this, to them, for what they were used to, was a walk in the park. A couple hours, few hours. So they would go in, and a pre-selected site on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and this was in Laos, a denied area, which is one of the reasons why it was so classified.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't supposed to be there. Neutral country, so they said. But anyway, go in, drop the ammo off, maybe fake a firefight, make some noise, attract some attention, get on the helicopter and head out, and hopefully the intention was to disperse that ammo through our enemy's supply channels.
Have you had a chance to speak with the other personnel who, the family of the other personnel that were involved? Are they somehow a part of this documentary?
Unfortunately, no. I have reached out to a couple of nephews and stuff and have talked to them, but for some reason that has been one thorn in our side to try to get the contact info. So it's been very, very, in a way, it's always been back in my mind and making sure that, you know, even though we are using these names and telling the story, that it's respectful. Because first of all, I would love nothing to do more than to say, hey, this is what I'm doing. I just want to make you aware. But the few that I've talked to are very receptive, very happy, and happy that it's being done. But there are a few that we haven't been able to reach.
Okay, we're speaking with Gold Star son Richard Fitz Jr. We'll talk a little bit about a documentary that he's in the works right now. Where does this stand right now as we're talking on this day? Are you near completion? Are you editing? Where are you at?
We're kind of final post editing. I think we're about 95% done. We just recently added a segment that was very difficult that we caught last minute, and it was very, you know, handheld camera type of thing, and we were really debating how we could use it. Because the quality wasn't, you know, as well as everything else was put together, but we figured out a way to do it, and so we kind of last minute throwing that in. But the soundtrack and everything else, of which I compiled and actually composed probably over 2/3 of it myself, all that is pretty much done. And I think after this, probably another few weeks of this editing, it's going to go into the soundtrack mastering, and so it should be done pretty soon. I'm say about 95% complete.
I think one of the things that I said to you prior to our kind of talking during the break was that kind of reading over some of the stuff, and thank you very much for all of the stuff that you sent me, and I feel privileged that I have an opportunity to sit here and kind of have a conversation with you about this. Again, this is somebody who served our country, and you're somebody who's trying to get to the bottom of what happened and tell a story, and that to me is very interesting. What was it like for you to sit down and take everything that you had compiled in regards to the disappearance of your father and the different puzzle pieces that you were able to kind of collect and lay out?
Well, on an emotional level, I guess you kind of go numb. I guess I focused so much on getting the story done that I didn't really delve into the emotional part. What has been going on since my father's remains were returned, which was in late 89, and we had a huge funeral in January of 90, enormous, here in Massachusetts in Abington. The rest of the commingled remains are buried together with all the names on a stone in Arlington National. But since then, every little piece of information has been trickling in, and that's exactly how it's been hitting me, little by little. So the whole project was, I don't think I ever had necessarily a goal to do a documentary or a story as such. But I can tell you what it's been like is a bit surreal. Again, it was difficult, but you have to understand that some of these guys, I'm sitting there interviewing, and I'll tell you right now, the only reason they agreed to interview was because I am there. The guy that they knew that they served with, I am his only son. That's the only reason they did it. And it's the only reason they agreed to it. Because these guys are still, even though everything's declassified now, finally, they still do not, they don't like to talk about it. So it was surreal in a way where I almost had to step out of who I was to sit and do this job that I've never done before. I've never interviewed people. I've never done any of this. And so I really had to just be a different person in a way and try to focus on what I was doing.
How do you prepare yourself? You're talking about something that you've never done before. Me, I lost count of how many interviews I've done. Mm-hmm. I really have. And each one is unique unto itself. But there's a nervousness before sitting down here with you. It's a nervousness of making sure that I'm telling, that we're having a conversation, that when you walk out that door at 8 p.m. tonight, you're going to go, you know, that was a good interview, And I feel satisfied that we answered. I was able to answer a lot of questions and put that information out there. You always, as an interviewer, you always like that. You going in, what was it like for you sitting down with these people? Did you have that feeling? Or was it just a matter of...
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, it goes right back to Rudy Childs. This is a gentleman that I was with. Here's an ironic little story, if I may stick this in here real quick.
Absolutely.
Again, I've already talked to you about the music thing. And we've kind of seen each other in the past through that. But I've always been a local guy and kind of up on local music and what's happening. Mm. This particular gentleman I met through a friend in the music industry. I had heard his name. I knew that he had done rock and roll videos. I knew he did rock and roll documentaries that were quite successful, etc. Mm. At the time, I really didn't know his extent of his experience, which was much more vast than just the music. But it was a simple day, and my friend said, "Rudy Childs, this is Richard Fitz. I don't know if you've met." And he looked at me and said, "Richard Fitz." He goes, "Are you related to the Fitz in Abington that was missing in action for 21 years?
Wow.
I said, "Yeah, kind of. I'm his only son."
That'd blow your mind.
Blow your mind, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, here's something crazy. So I said, "You're into videos and this and that." I said, "I've had all this stuff, old newscasts, articles, stuff that, this story was huge for years. And especially when the big funeral was there, I had a lot of stuff." I simply asked him, "I need to save this stuff. Can you help me convert it digital so I don't lose it all? Because it's literally in my basement, who knows, right?" He goes, "You know what's weird is my parents were good friends with your father's parents, your grandparents on your father's side, for years." He goes, "I actually went to D.C. after your father's funeral and did a video for your grandparents. And since my grandparents had passed, I had accumulated some of their stuff they had as well." So he agreed to help me. I went up to his studio with a giant tote full of stuff. He reaches down, the first thing he picks out, he goes, "This is the tape that I made for your grandparents." I had no idea. Then that's how this started coming around. So that in itself, I had any idea that I was going to do a story or anything. But when it came down to all this, his understanding and procedures and how to do interviews is what helped me through this whole procedure. So he was able to coach me a little bit, and as the early interviews progressed, he's like completely comfortable with me doing it now because I was able to, thankfully, have a common sense. First of all, it is close to my story, so I have a good common sense about what should be happening.
Mm.
I just never, at the time, needed a little guidance and a little push to basically get the ball rolling so I could go with it. And once I got that, once I get his guidance, and we still do it today, we'll do something, he'll sit back and say, probably try this or that, this might work better, and this is why. And, once all those things happened, I was completely comfortable with it.
So that experience has paid off working with a gentleman like Rudy Childs who knows how to do a documentary, probably understands putting together an outline, how it should flow.
Right.
Because when you're putting something together like that, it's almost like writing a book. You probably have more information than you need.
Right.
But you also want to make sure that it's something that is going to flow, it's going to tell a story, mm-hmm. and not take someone down a path that's not needed. You want to make sure you give all the pertinent information.
And that's kind of, in two ways, that's what's good, what was great for this, and almost frustrating for him in a way, because I had people for years telling me, "I had a great story, I should do a book." And I said, "I don't have any time or patience for a book." But there were certain things that happened that I said, "I really got to do something." I told Rudy in one of those early meetings, I've been toying with the idea of getting something together and it's maybe a documentary or something. But the fact that, first of all, that he agreed to that, and the fact that he had the patience enough to allow me to keep coming back and almost second-guessing and changing, because I never had a storyline, per se. There's always things I knew that should go in, but I didn't know how to arrange them, as you say, because there's more than just putting information. It has to flow.
Yeah.
For people to be entertained and watch this, the reality of it.
It's very
important. It has to flow. So I really had no concept as far as video goes. But I kept going back to my roots and go, it's really the same thing as a song. You know, you really have to make sure it has continuity and flow and it moves and it takes you somewhere. It's really just a different adaptation, but there's so many more different technical sides of it.
Sure.
Which he came into play. So, I mean, all this was, you know, we've been back and forth, and I think Rudy admitted a couple times, too, that he works in a different way and he has a certain structure. And so when I'd come in, it really jarbled his way of, you know, doing things. So it got a little frustrating.
It created a challenge, but it was...
But he even admitted, he says, you know, once we all started getting going and got in this rhythm, he allowed himself to let go a little bit and allow my ideas to come through. And then once we did that, we worked on the flow, and it was like butter, you know. It's really well, you know.
No, and especially with today's technology, myself, other than being a radio guy, I'm also, I do TV production. Mm-hmm. I understand video. The software that they have out there these days is, depending on if you're a Final Cut,
right,
like Adobe Premiere, whatever it is, there's so many little things, little apps that you can use that will enhance video or it can give you a certain effect, which is really, right, really cool.
Right. And some of that he was, you know, he's the technical wizard on this. And again, even the soundtrack. I wanted so much to be involved in it because that's where I come from.
Yep.
And, you know, people say it is a labor of love. And I guess it's, I don't really realize that because I never knew my father. So that type of love is kind of hard to connect with. But in a way, it's such a part of me that I felt, you know, adamant about getting myself involved in a music way because that's who I am.
Right.
So even with that, you know, he was used to doing his own stuff in the soundtrack. And I actually bought an upgraded program and I started learning all this stuff at my house and just started recording stuff. I used stuff that I've done with previous projects. I used silly sounds around the house. I just started creating.
It's not a bad thing, though.
It works.
Yeah.
And that's all it is, too. And it's, you know, about the four type of files and formats and all this. We went through it all, you know, and each of us learned. And I'm still learning. But what I'm doing is working. So.
Yeah, we are speaking with Gold Star family member Richard Fitz Jr. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and we hope that you're enjoying this particular segment of the program. Once you finally get this project completed, what's the plans there? Now, I don't know, as far as you mentioned your grandparents who are no longer with us.
Correct.
But is your mom still with us? Do you have other family members of your dad's or other family members that the idea, the intent after you've completed this, sit them down and let them watch this?
Yes. Well, my mother was interviewed in this. She's been, you know, she's been right along with the whole thing. I have cousins that know, that have like seen early versions or, you know, that know about it. There's not many that side of the family really left. And, you know, a lot of us early in the 70s, we kind of went separate ways. And which, you know, from what I've talked to a lot of these Gold Star families, not an uncommon thing. It does happen. So I'm going to tell you that everybody's aware of what's going on. Everybody's behind it. And some have seen early pieces of it. You know, but sometimes I get a little stubborn. I'd rather, like, wait for the, you know, the final or when I know it's real close.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You know, and you just like to make sure that, you know, you get the good stuff, you know, that everybody sees. And, you know, that's when you get, you know, pat yourself on the back when your close relatives or whatever are proud of it and see the finished product. Because it's vastly different than when it started, thankfully. That's what it should be, you know.
How much more have you learned about your dad since you embarked on this project?
A ton more. Details especially. I was able to, if I can just kind of add this in, the unit that he was in, again, I keep saying that it was a classified unit, but it was extremely highly classified. We do have a gentleman that was involved in these units that do an interview for us, and, you know, he broke it down by numbers and how many, you know, 3-point-some-odd million soldiers served in Vietnam, and it goes all the way down to there was 2,000 Green Berets that served in that war. But 400 to 600 ran recon only, and your dad was part of that. That's how elite that unit was. So when you start talking about this, general audience, this is one thing we tried to do, is to, and I had to do it in my own life, I had to bridge the military gap to the civilian gap. And that's kind of what we try to do. We try to keep everything at a level where there's not too many acronyms. But if you can understand, this unit was so classified that they were sworn to secrecy for over 20 years. They were also, this unit, there was other special forces units activated in serving that weren't even allowed to know what this unit was about. So it was really, really, you know, tip of the edge. All their orders were higher echelons of the Pentagon or directly from the White House. So when I was finding all this stuff out, you know, we still didn't know a lot. There was not a lot of records kept. There were records that were destroyed in a fire. You know, there was a lot of conspiracy theories about that one. But they weren't doing these missions for the medals. You know, they don't do it. That's not how they work.
It's kind of interesting. And again, something else that I said to you prior to our coming on microphone, and that was that, you know, reading over your father's story, I mean, this is stuff that we see in movies, that we see on TV, that we see on a regular basis. But what we have here, this is real life.
Exactly.
How does that make you feel?
It's really surreal because it's, at once, you know, there are times where I guess it's natural for an only son to sit there and do a little chest beating. It's crazy. But by going, I've been thankfully honored to be able to go to this unit's reunions and meet people that knew my father or served with him, and that's where we got some of the interviews and the information. But I can tell you, the craziest thing about it is you almost get a Hollywood type of vision in your head.
It's easy to do.
It is. And when you go to these and sit with these gentlemen, you really are like, you look around and you're like, this could be the type of guy this guy is, could be my buddy that I grew up in high school with or the guy down the road. It's so unassuming in a way. Okay, and so you that whole Hollywood persona just goes out. I mean, once in a while you see, you know, big Jack guy or whatever, you know, but you just, the stories you hear and you look at the people that are doing it is really unbelievable. You know, it's all about heart, and you know what they wanted to do their missions, and what they did pull off was incredible.
We just got a couple of moments left here, and Richard, we want to thank you for joining us. Is there a planned screening? Are you still raising funds to be able to complete this?
Yeah.
And do you have information that if folks have any outreach, who knows, there may be maybe a last-minute individual who knows something that, while it's probably impossible, I never rule anything out, right, that maybe if they wanted to reach out and contact you.
Well, we do have my personal Facebook page, Richard A. Fitz, or the other page that I have is Staff Sergeant Richard A. Fitz documentary. I'm usually posting on either one about locals, up-to-date happenings of what's going on with the project. There are a few ways you can donate. You can go to the GoFundMe, which I think it says Fund My Story, Green Beret Father. You can donate directly to the Rockland Trust in Abington, which I believe is Center Street in Abington. And that's, again, attention, Green Beret Father Story. Or you can keep your eye out for local screenings. We're desperately looking for a few venues right now. We want to do a couple this summer. There will be some backing from some of the radio stations that, you know, we've
chatted with.
To.
Yep,
yep. And there's going to be a big debut with that. But there will be some more sneak previews around. We have entered it. The film did very well in Ocean City Film Festival in Maryland. And that out of, you know, you have hundreds and hundreds of entries into these things, but they picked 100. They picked us. Out of that 100, we were one vote away from the Audience Choice Award.
What?
And that was an unfinished version months ago. It has grown and changed leaps and bounds since that happened. So we have a good product here, and we do want to do some showings.
Any thought? I know that local filmmakers usually go to the Randolph Cinema. I don't know if it's something, maybe Kingston. Would you be able to go to a cinema like that, knowing that it's a national chain, and see if you'd be able to rent out or be able to utilize that theater space?
I had a couple of people approach me about that. And there's, you know, again, like you said, with the technology, sometimes a lot of it can be portable and you can go surprising places and do it. We're looking into right now, I can't say that it's going to happen, but the moving wall is coming in July.
That's right.
Down at Union Point.
Yep.
So we are trying to see if we can't figure out to do a preview there. There's nothing set in stone, but we are asking the questions and trying to get that to happen, because that would be a real, real great addition to that weekend. Because all the Vietnam veterans that are coming home, coming to the wall, probably be very interested in seeing it. And it tells, our story doesn't just tell about my father. It doesn't just tell about a Green Beret and his son that didn't know him. We tie in a lot of different things, a lot of local stories and a lot of meaning. And so it ties into a lot of different people. So, I think it's going to be interesting for a lot of people, maybe cathartic for a lot of people. I think my general goal for this really is if somebody sees this story, especially today, if it's a child that has to go through what I did, on the other end of this, you can come out with a little bit of pride. And, you know, I tell everybody I could have been the perfect candidate for, you know, I hate the government or this or that, and, you know, have a lot of bad, bad feelings. And, it's not about that. And, I hope it touches people in a way that they can understand that, you know, we sacrificed too, but we sacrificed for everybody's freedoms and the way we live our life. And hopefully, you know, that's a lot to be proud of.
Well, we're out of time now, but I'll ask you one quick question. Seeing how well you've come through this to put this documentary together, any chances that you might consider doing a book? I know it's kind of usually you put the book out first, then you pare down the movie. But
exactly why I did this. I got no patience for that.
Yeah, any chance that you might consider sitting down with a ghostwriter and doing a book?
I would say never. I would never say never.
Okay.
You know, that's one thing. I have to take everything one project at a time,
okay,
and one thought at a time.
All right, just want to put it on your plate. If you eat it, fine. If not, again, it's one of those ideas. But I want to thank you very much for coming in studio, sharing your story, sharing your family story, and hopefully this is going to be something that is well received by the public. Who knows? Maybe it could be something that is eyeballed by a larger company, and maybe they might want to do a bigger production.
That'd be great. I know once it's first done, the Special Operations Association will have it as part of their Living History Project to keep some of their history alive. So that's a big feather in our cap too. But if it goes that route, then great. If more people hear our story, what more can you ask for?
Excellent. There he is, Richard Fitz Jr. Here telling a story, talking about his dad, the Green Beret, who one fateful day went missing in Vietnam. Be sure to keep your eye open for those screenings that'll be in and around the South Shore and maybe other screenings in the Massachusetts area or beyond.
Probably national.
Okay. Yeah. We'll look forward to that. Please stay in touch with us. And, folks, that's all the time that we have here on Monday Night Talk. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.